Alright, I'm risk-free, as you can tell, and my speak is entitled Encryption for Programmers, but it's kind of misleading because I'm only talking about the very basics. So if you know anything about cryptography or encryption, you're going to be bored. This is where everyone stands up and leaves. I guess everyone is ready to learn something then. I'm just going to basically go over very, very short introductory and explain the difference between a code and a cipher, because a lot of people think that a code is a cipher and vice versa. They don't know the difference between the code and the cipher. And then I'll just go into some concepts and examples of current encryption schemes, and just very briefly I'll go through those just to give an example of different types of encryption that is out there. And then I'll go into the legalities. Believe it or not, there is some legality over encryption programming, especially in the United States anyway. Okay, what is cryptography? Cryptography is defined as language and math techniques for securing information. Now, that is very straightforward. Basically, it's telling you how to keep your information secure, be it data, files, messages, anything like that. There are many parts to cryptography, encryption, decryption, obviously, and steganography, which is hiding messages inside other messages or hiding stuff inside graphics. And I won't go into that in this talk, but I probably will go into that in another talk for a different con, maybe. So what is encryption? It's the conversion from plain text to ciphertext. And plain text is basically your English, whatever you want to type in English or whatever language you speak, your native language, and you want to convert it to something else that's unreadable just right away. And that is called your ciphertext. Now, historically, encryption's been used primarily for military communications. Dates back down to Julius Caesar, hence the Caesar cipher, which I'll talk about later. And yeah, historically, it's just for military purposes until the more modern eras. But for now, we use it for digital signatures. I'm sure you've heard of PGP. We use it for voting, for cash transactions, PayPal. I'm sure you don't want to send your bank information unsecured. And we basically use it everywhere now. You'll see it anywhere. All right, the difference between a code and a cipher. This is something that you probably want to get down if you don't know already. Now, a code is like a code word for something. And it's just using words or phrases and substituting them for something else. Like saying, let's go to the docks. You might mean, let's go get a beer or something like that. See, it's just regular substitution. It's very, very easy. Now, a cipher, on the other hand, is the actual changing of the data into something else. And you'll see that in all the examples that I give. And it's normally controlled by a key, such as a keyword or some random letters, or if you use a random number generator or something like that, which you'll see later on. Now, there are two main categories of encryption algorithms, and that's symmetric key algorithms and asymmetric key algorithms. Symmetric key is a private key, and I'll talk about the differences between private key and public key, and just some examples, DES and AES, if you just want to keep it in the back of your mind when we go through these. And asymmetric key algorithms is also known as public key, and that's like RSA stuff. All right, symmetric key encryption, I said it was private key encryption, meaning that there's one key and it's private, so you don't give it out to anyone, otherwise they can encrypt and decrypt all your data, and that's kind of pointless if you give that out. And it works with blocks and streams. I'll discuss blocks and streams in the next slide, and so don't worry about that right now. And again, examples, AES, DES, and RC4. DES and AES are block ciphers, however, RC4 is a stream cipher. I don't discuss RC4 in this talk, but I do discuss DES and AES. For blocks and streams, okay, the very basic principles of a block cipher is that it's operating on a fixed length of bytes, or bits, or however much stuff you want to encrypt. Now, most of them just use, like, 32 bits, or 8 bits, or 4 bytes, or whatever it may be. And it's normally controlled by the secret key, and you'll see this later on in the examples that I'll go through. What happens is you take the plain text, however much of that you want to encrypt, say 4 bits, and then you'll take 4 bits of the secret key, and then you'll combine that into the block cipher to get your ciphertext, and it'll do that for each part of the message. Whereas a stream cipher, it operates on 1 bit or a byte, so each bit or byte in the message will change. Asymmetric key encryption, like I said, is public key, and this is probably what you're more known for. It'll combine it with, like, XOR, and you'll see later. I'll show you. Okay, asymmetric key, like I said, is public key. This is probably you're more familiar with PGP and stuff, where you see people posting the little signatures and stuff with their PGP keys. And it uses two keys, the public key for encryption, for encrypting stuff, and your private key for decryption, so only you can decrypt the messages. And it's also used, you know, digital signing. There's also more, obviously, more DSA and Algomol. I don't talk about those, so I'm just throwing them out. These are the number of, well, the types of algorithms I'm going to discuss. The Alberti or the Vinier, the Rot13, they're all very similar. Caesar ciphers, and I'll discuss those like right now. The other ones, don't worry about until later. And one-time pads, you might think not useful for computer use, and you're probably wondering why. So I'll get to that later. All right, the Alberti, I guess, is one of the first Caesar ciphers. It was made in 1466 by Leon Battista Alberti. And after that came the Vinier cipher. And these are all sort of going off the same principle of substituting the alphabet, as seen in this example, where they'll just move stuff over. And probably the most familiar one is the Rot13. I'm sure everyone has heard of it. And basically what it does is just rotate 13 places. I mean, you don't want to use that for anything. Well, polyalphabetic means just one alphabet. So it's just moving the one. It just uses one alphabet, like the English alphabet or something. Does that help? All right. An interesting thing about the Rot13 encryption, I don't know if some of you have heard about it. In 2001, cryptanalysis. A Russian guy, he broke this company's ebook security. And what they did was encrypt all of their documents in Rot13. So it's kind of pointless, but it's included in the Adobe ebook development thing. So I don't think you'd ever want to use that to encrypt anything. See, 1466, the Alberti encryption was made by, he was a Renaissance scholar. In 1586, the Vinier cipher, he was a French diplomat and a cryptographer, and it's a good example of bad encryption. This is a simple, very simple Perl program I made. You can see by the example, you're substituting all of the alphabet, and you can either input with a file or whatever you want to do for your input. and you can export it to the screen, or you can throw it into a file, or do whatever with it. Now, when people refer to RAT26, like you guys are talking about up here, RAT26 doesn't use any encryption, because what it'll do, it'll rotate 13, and it'll rotate 13 more, and that just brings it back to the plain text. It's no use. However, you can use RAT47, which will do it by 47 places, and might throw people off a little bit more than they might think 13. Alright, DES. I'm sure you've all heard of DES, and EFF's great cracker for this way back. It's very insecure. Very insecure. It was first published in 1975, and in 1977 the federal government standardized it. At the time it was fairly good. It uses a 64-bit block size and a 56-bit key size. And these things will be explained more as I explain how it works. Same with the structure. The structure is called Feistel. It's made after Horst Feistel. He designed it, and it uses 16 rounds of this. Now, the Feistel structure, all the operations of the structure are very similar to each other, and it only requires a reversal of the key to be able to encrypt and decrypt. So it's not too terribly complicated. And it uses repeated operations such as bit shuffling, which are called P-boxes, like permutation boxes. You'll see this all the time when you're dealing with cryptography. And nonlinear functions, these are called S-boxes for substitution. And you'll see S-boxes and P-boxes all the time. And linear mixing using the exclusive OR, that's used quite a bit as well. This diagram shows how DES actually encrypts its stuff. What it first does is takes the first block and it expands it using the subkey or a key that you used, and it mixes them together to form 16 subkeys. And then what it'll do is it'll substitute those, as you can see by the S boxes, and then it's divided into 8 pieces, and they'll go to work substituting and changing all the data in there.
What's a half block?
The half block is the half part. It'll split the message up into.
What is it composed of?
It's your message.
Oh, okay.
Because it'll split up the original message into however much you want to specify, and it'll take half of that and it'll use your key for the other half. And then after it's in the substitution boxes, it'll go on to permeate into a fixed P-box. And DES, like I said, is very insecure. Don't use it for anything anymore. The next one is AES, Advanced Encryption Standard. Sometimes it's also called the Rheingel. I don't know how to pronounce if I'm pronouncing that right. What is it? Rheingel. Okay. And it is the U.S. government standard right now. It's first published in 1998. In 2001, it became the standard. It uses a 128-bit block size, 128, 192, or 256-bit key size, so you can change those if you need to. And it uses a substitution permutation structure, not the Feistel structure, which you previously saw. And it can use 10, 12, or 14 rounds. Alright. AES begins with a 4x4 array, which is often called the state. Now, the first thing that it does, and this is kind of like pseudocode, the first part I wrote, subbytes. That can be a function that you use. It's a substitution with a lookup table. Now, I'll go into detail each one of these steps. This is just kind of an overview. Then it goes into shift rows, which is transposition, and then mixes and combines all of the data. And then it'll add a round key. The final round does not mix the columns. Okay, the first one is subbytes, and it uses linear substitution. Basically, what it's doing is going to make up the lookup table. It's just going to basically copy this stuff over. And then it's going to actually shift the rows. As you can see by the numbers, it just shifts it one row over. And then you go into the mixed columns. Use the fixed polynomial as seen in XOR, which it'll help that transform it. And it's going to add the round key. Now, it's going to take from the state, it's going to take the block, and then from the key, it'll take that and XOR those two, and finally that'll be added into the lookup table with the round key. And an implementation for this, if you want some source code to do with this, I have the site listed here, and I'll put this up on my website, and I'll have the address for that stuff at the end. But this code is BSD licensed, and it includes a Visual Studio workspace and source code with assembly source code if you want that too, as well as a Windows DLL if you ever want to do Windows stuff with it. The next one is RSA. It is asymmetric, means public key, and it was the first cipher for signing and encryption. And this is kind of confusing, this part here. It was first described in 1973 by Clifford Cox of the GCHQ. But in 1977, Ron Rivest, Addy Shamir, and Len Alderman described it too. Now, we didn't know about the Clifford Cox one in 1973 because he was working for the British government at the time. And while he was working on it, it was classified information, so he didn't actually get the claim to fame for this one. And this is sort of how RSA works. You'll take, and it uses prime numbers, because prime numbers are sometimes very hard to calculate unless you have a lot of computing power. Okay, this is first how it works. Well, I'll get back to you on that. I mean, I don't know the general like math of how people know math, so I'll just get back to you on that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess I should say I'm not an expert at this stuff. I'm learning this stuff as a hobby and stuff, and I just like to show some people like what you can do and stuff. Okay, this is how RSA works. The first prime number that you calculate, we'll call it P, and you're either going to keep this secret or you're just going to delete it. Now, if you delete it, you want to make sure you delete it securely and not just throw it off somewhere. Your second prime, we're going to call that Q, and we're going to keep that secret or delete it securely again. And for N, we're going to take P times Q, which is your modulus, and that's going to be public. So people can see that if they need to. Now, E is going to be public exponent, which, again, public, people can see, doesn't matter. And D is going to be your private exponent. Again, private, get rid of securely. Now, your public key is actually E and N, and your private key is D. Now, to encrypt M, which is your plain text, you're going to take M to the power of E mod N, which will give you M to the power of 17 mod 3233. And to decrypt, it's basically reverse of that stuff there. And on the bottom, you can see the examples, just if you want to encrypt simple numbers. RSA needs to use padding schemes. Otherwise, it'll be too easy to calculate the numbers. You got to throw in some stuff to, take people away from the actual numbers that you want to calculate. Because if you have M, as in M on that page, as 0 or 1, your output will always be 0 or 1. And that will easily give it away unless you use some kind of padding. And low exponents may be less than your modulus. And if you use low exponents, that'll be too easy to decrypt. So you don't want to use low exponents. You got to make sure you have high exponents. So computing power is definitely preferred with this. And for digital signing, it's quite easy. You just take a hash, and you can use anything for that, any kind of hashing you want to do, if you want to make your own. And take that to the power of D, your private exponent, and mod N, which will give you X. I take X to the power of E mod N, should give you the hash. If it doesn't, then you know it's been tampered with. Now, Blowfish is my favorite, because in 1993, Bruce Schneier made it, and he made it public domain, which is very cool with all of these. It has a block size of 64 bits, and a key size from 32 to 448 bits. And again, it has a FISTEL structure, like seen before, with 16 rounds. And you can see the implementation on Bruce Schneier's website. He has plenty of source code links. I know there's C, C++, there's Python, Perl, I think there's even COBOL up there. I don't know how they did that. And that's basically how Blowfish works. What it'll do is it'll split it up into 8 bits and throw those into an S-box. The substitution will substitute the stuff. And then we'll use modular addition from the output of those S-boxes, and then it'll go into modular addition with all 4 of those S-boxes. It'll do this for each part of the message. And then that'll give you your output with all the modular addition parts there. RC5, there are plenty of RC codes. RC stands for Rives Cipher, or Ron's code, as Ron Rives made it. It was first published in 1994, has a block size of 32, 64, or 128 bits, the key size up to 2040 bits. Again, it has a FISTEL structure with 12 rounds. And RC5 and RC6 are both proprietary for RSA security, so source code is... documentation is not as good as you would want it to be. Again, it's a block cipher, same with RC5. However, RC6 was made by Ron Rivest. Let's see, I think it was Matt Robshaw. Okay, I forget their full names. Block size of 128-bit, key sizes of 128-bit, 192, or 256-bit. Now, one-time pads, they're very simple to implement, and I don't know how many of you know about one-time pads, but computers don't use, pens and papers and stuff, and that's how this stuff is mainly implemented. And basically, you need a pad. So what you'll do is take, say, a Scrabble bag with all the numbers and letters, and you'll take out the letters and write them down on a pad for how many you need on your message. Say your message is hello. So you only take out that many number or more if you need more. And see, it has to have the same length at least, otherwise there's no point. Now the drawback to this is you have to have it completely random. If it's not random, then it'll be easily brute forced. And again, you need secure exchange of that. If you don't have secure exchange and somebody looks at the numbers that you picked out, what good is it going to do? And it's one-time use. I mean, you can't reuse the same numbers or letters that you used in the first part. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to be any use. And that goes into integrity. Now, if one-time pads, the integrity deals with all of the secure exchange and the secure generation of the letters and numbers. Make sure all that stuff is secure so no one sees this stuff. And these are simple how to do this stuff. So we're going to take hello, and we're going to give a numerical value to each letter in the alphabet, starting with 0. And then say we take out 5 letters from a Scrabble bag, and we get J-E-P-S-W. What we're going to do is take the numerical values of hello and J-E-P-S-W, and we're going to add those together. Now you might think, well, 11 plus 15 is more than 25. So what you do is you just come back and start at the beginning and keep going, which gives us then Q-I-A-D-J. That's how you encrypt the stuff. Now, to decrypt it, it's basically the reverse. Where we were adding to encrypt, we're just going to subtract the letters. So, see, again, when you subtract them, they might not come out to the end, so you just gotta go back to the alphabet and keep going. Just gotta go through it, and that should give you hello. Very simple. And I just wanted to cover it because it is a very basic way to do stuff. It's very unbreakable as long as you don't have, you know, the same stuff over and over again. Now the legalities. This kind of surprised me a bit. There are no U.S. import laws, thankfully. However, the U.S. did sign the Wassenaar Agreement. And this agreement is really long, so I did not even bother to read most of it. However, they do have something in there called the General Software Note. It was in December 1998, I believe. And it says, software is not included as restricted technology if it is generally available to the public. Such as, you know, if you make something and you give out the source code, then that's generally available. However, if your code is or was made before 1998, then it does not fall into this category. So you can't export it then. And however, there is a lot more laws than just what I've described. So if you want more information on that, the two websites here. The first one is this guy, Bert Koops, is his PhD website. He went through almost, I don't want to say every country, but a giant list of countries and actually got the laws for each country. And it's huge. It's a great website, by the way. And then, obviously, the Wassenaar website, wassenaar.org, for more information. They don't give out, actually, too much information on their website. So, I mean, they do some, but you can't find the explicit laws on there, which was very surprising to me. So, any questions? I know there will probably be some.
Have you actually ever heard the Lorenz speak about
No, I haven't. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anything else? I know I kind of went through this fast, but I'm tired, not much sleep. And I'll throw this on my website, and you can download it. I'll have all the links up there and stuff if you want to take a look at it. Anything else? You'll see email is the biggest one. I mean, a lot of people want secure transfer of your emails. I mean, you want people reading your emails. And another one that I know is very useful is instant messaging. I know a lot of companies that use instant messaging within the corporate environment, and a lot of the stuff is encrypted. I know AIM is encrypted, and MSN, they use SSL for all their instant messages. But I think email is definitely the biggest thing right there. Any more?
The other application for email is signing.
Yes, yeah. That work that comes in with PGP and stuff.
And it lets you make sure that not only is the person who sent you an email, is it really from them?
Well, with the random generation of your pad, your random letters, and if, say if you use, I'll go back to it. Say we use JEPSW, and we pad it with the rest of the alphabet just randomly. I mean, it's really hard to guess this stuff, and especially when you're adding and subtracting the numerical values. And you can, like, I use 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You can start with any number. So you can just change the numbers and pad it, and it's really hard to break. I've tried it definitely many times.